You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome
to Theater Geeks Anonymous,
the podcast about Broadway flops, scandals, and new work.
I'm your host, Ebony Vines.
And I'm your host, Pamela Shandro.
Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the Theater Geeks Anonymous podcast
on the Broadway Podcast Network and all your favorite podcast listening apps.
Thank you.
I don't know. That's like my woohoo, except 2022 version. Oh, that is a good episode of My Favorite Murder where they're talking about that. Because like as soon as she said it, I knew exactly what she was talking about.
I can't whistle either.
I know. Well, I can. I can whistle pretty well.
I cannot. I'm a wheat wooer.
You're a wheat wooer. If you all don't know what we're talking about, My Favorite Murder is another podcast. It's fantastic. It's a comedy murder podcast, so it's a little bit sensitive for people that are easily triggered by that stuff. Yeah. But we find it very funny because the two hosts, Georgia and Karen, are very funny.
Yeah.
And also very engaging. But as when they're talking to each other in the podcast, much like Ebony and I are right now, they'll have these kind of conversations. And one of the conversations was actually in the process of telling a murder story. But Georgia was saying that the person that she was talking about in the story heard a wheat woo. Karen just was kind of playing along at first, but then realized, wait a minute, are you trying to, like, is that a whistle? Like, that was an actual whistle? And she's like, yeah, I can't whistle, though, so I just say wheat woo. But who doesn't know what you're talking about you say wheat woo? That you're talking about. I love it. Makes me so happy. Anywho. Just plug in other podcasts.
Yeah, we do that a lot. But I feel like other podcasts I listen to do that as well.
Well, you know what? That is true to life.
Yeah.
Because if you're excited about something, you want to share it with people, even if it's not going to, you know, give you any kind of a gain.
Yeah.
We don't do things for gain.
No, just because it's fun.
You just started listening. We don't do things for gain. But if you've been listening for a while, you know we don't do things for gain. We do this because we love it. We love talking about theater. It's cathartic. I've got this weird, like, little baby curl kind of sticking out. I just saw a video of in the video. I'm all over the place today. This should be fun.
Okay, well, you have to start us.
I know. I will start you. But first, I want to tell you what I ate for lunch today.
Okay.
Because it was so good and it was just recent. Mm-hmm. So I'm still kind of tasting it. So I like to get a lot of stuff at Costco, like a lot of frozen stuff and pantry goods at Costco because it lasts longer and I don't have to do shopping, but like once a month.
Yeah.
Except for like the perishable items and that I can just do going to the grocery store or like getting, you know, a ShopRite delivery or whatever, or Stop and Shop, whatever. Anyway, so I've got these and I've had them before, but I haven't had them for a very long time. Salmon burgers. Okay. Oh, I think it's really just like salmon, onion, garlic, maybe. Like, there's not a lot of filler in these little patties. It's mostly salmon, but the flavor.
That sounds good.
Yeah. I had that and I just mixed it up in a bowl of cilantro lime rice. It was really good.
That sounds really good.
Yeah. It was good.
I bought a couple of cans of salmon. And my mom and grandmother used to be really good at, I mean, they were great at crab cakes, but then they were really good at salmon cakes too.
Yeah.
And so they used to just make, especially in the summer, we'd have lots and lots of crab cakes, fresh crab. And then I think salmon mom was actually bigger on the salmon cakes thing. So,
You know what?
And had that in such a long time.
I love crab, but the flavor of crab is lost to me in a crab cake. in a crab cake, it becomes much more about the other ingredients, but salmon, because it's so much of a forward flavor, you cannot dismiss it when you're eating it in a cake form.
Yeah.
Like it's really good. So that I think I'm with your mom on that.
Yeah. She, I mean, I think too, the salmon was just like more readily available. Like my grandmother had, I'll never forget being a kid, and it sounds like we were going for drugs, but I tell you, we weren't. I swear we weren't. I remember being a kid in the back seat of a car, and we would drive up to this woman's house in Baltimore. And like in my head, I still remember like these staircases that to me look really tall.
Yeah.
And into this big house, and this black lady would come out with these tubs of crab. And she would give them to my grandmother, and that's what my grandmother would use to make her crab cakes. But I think it was because it was fresh and they take forever to like pick out, right?
Yeah.
And my grandmother just didn't have the time to do that. So she knew this lady who was probably somebody she knew from church, or a church person who knew a church person, something like that, right? And that's how, that's what she would most of the time make them with. And then of course, like, my uncle would buy the bushels, and that's when we would have them fresh with the corn they picked from the farm.
Oh, and they just pour it on the table covered in newspaper and go to town. I love it.
Old Bay hammers.
Oh, yum. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds delightful. There is nothing better than steamed corn with Old Bay. Nothing better.
No, Old Bay is majestic.
It's
good. It's one of the best spices in the world.
Now, I also am a fan of Tony Sachery's. He's got like a spicy kind of Cajun seasoning that I'm also real, like that. I really love it. It's spicy, but it's good.
I like spicy.
Yeah.
I have to try it.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
I've got it. So if you want to borrow some.
Ooh, that sounds good. Okay. Yeah. Where do you pick it up around here? Berry Fresh, Trade Fair?
Do you know what? I didn't get it here. I bought it when we were, I mean, either in Illinois or like when we were on vacation in Alabama. But yeah, I feel like it's a grocery store item. Okay. It comes in a green canister with a little, like it's got the picture of Tony Sachery. It's it looks like C-H-A-C-H-E-R-R-I-E apostrophe S, like Chacheries, but it's Sachery. Anyway, it's a Cajun name, which I suppose you could also say French, because that is where Cajun came from. And that was not Cajun. That was like more Jamaican. That was a terrible accent.
I don't even know what that was. I can't even place it.
And I'm going to leave it in because I'm all about showing my warts. Wow. But it's good. Yeah, I'll let you loan. I'll let you loan some. I'll let you borrow some.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, so I'm going to do the first episode today.
I know, but you didn't do your famous thing that you do. That's what I've been waiting for.
Welcome!
There it is.
That was beautiful. That came out. That was like all I had to do was open my mouth and it poured out of me.
It's a strong one.
That was a strong one.
It was. All welcome, good. Theater geeks. What's up?
Welcome. What is up? What is up?
You know, it's Theater Geeks Anonymous. I mean, you clicked on it. It's the only way to, you know, click on things.
You can't get here by accident.
No, no.
Nope.
So we have this week's a regular run, you know, episode, how we do.
We've got a couple that are coming up that are going to be regulars, unless something really exciting happens in the news, and then we'll do another intermission. But at this point, besides the fact that Leah Michelle is out with COVID.
Wah, wah. That was a real.
I'm sorry, but how and why? Like, this is what I don't.
Because nobody's wearing masks anymore.
But the rest of the cast is still in. Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, no, I shouldn't say that. Because actually there was a handful of people that were out.
And that's what I heard.
There's a little bit of controversy as far as that goes, too. Because they brought in a woman to play, I believe, Mrs. Bryce.
To cover her.
And she had to be on book for the first performance, maybe even a couple of the performances, right? And that was all fine and dandy. Like, she did great, right? But the uproar, I guess if you can call it that, is, and it's not even an uproar, it's just like a silent disappointment that's finally being voiced, is that these creatives and these people that are in charge never think ahead. They never have this idea of like, oh, what should we do in case this happens? And so mm-hmm. then they expect for these swings to just do it over and over and over and over and over again. And it's like, you know what? You've got half the cast out with COVID. Let's right. just call it a show and we'll open again when we're back. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. But they don't want to do that. They just want to kind of work people into the ground and then replace them when they need to.
Yeah.
So that's mm-hmm. a little frustration that's going on in the acting community right now.
Yes, it's valid. It's very yeah. valid.
Yeah, it is. And there's not, because listen, we know that people are talented enough to accomplish it.
Mm-hmm.
We're not saying that. We're saying that they shouldn't have to.
Right, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that is my 2 cents. If you would like another 2 cents. I mean, my eyebrows.
We haven't even gone to the big announcement, but we'll do that at the end of the episode.
Okay.
What's the one you texted me about?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Should we talk about it now?
No, let's do it at the end. Yeah, yeah.
I don't want the dogs to start barking, so that's probably a good idea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, awesome. Well, it's my turn today, and I'm going to talk about Fields of Ambrosia.
I don't remember. I have no living clue what in the world this is even about.
You're probably not alone. Let me...
Ambrosia is a green dessert.
Oh, dear.
With marshmallows, pistachios, pistachio pudding, and green jello.
Well, there was something...
fluff or Cool Whip.
That's Ambrosia was the food of the gods. If you want to like go back into like Greek...
Okay.
Greek writing.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point in the 1950s, they thought that the food of the gods should be jello, marshmallows, Cool Whip, and
pistachio
all of, like,
pudding.
And yeah, exactly. And just a bunch of really disgusting things put together into a mold and then eaten. Mm-hmm. I don't think of jello or pudding as dessert. That's just part of the meal itself. But or like a side dish. Uh-huh. But yeah, no, I mean, that sounds truly disgusting to me. I think in terms of what the title of this show represents is kind of someone's idea of what heaven is or okay. what it should be for someone.
Because I was like, otherwise it's Fields of Green Dessert.
Right. It's jello as far as the eye can see. Dotted with marshmallows.
In the shape of flowers.
And they're frolicking amongst the pistachios. So gross. And like sometimes people would put like fruit in there.
Yeah.
Gross. I'm just no.
Like pineapple. Yeah. Right.
Cherries, like not even Oof. Good cherries, but like maraschino cherries. Yeah. Gross. Yeah. I don't even Oof. Think you can consider maraschino cherries real cherries.
No.
Where did maraschino cherries come from and why? Like they have no place.
I don't know.
We have gone off the rails, but this is fun. Okay. So starting out with my references, I've got a website called ilesay.com. Aisle is spelled like a running down the aisle, like an aisle of a church.
Okay.
Ilesay.com. Wikipedia, of course. That was mm-hmm. my main source. I've got IBDB, IMDB, and just a whole other assortment of others that I will mention along the way.
Ooh, IMDB. That yeah. means there's a movie something.
How did you guess? So The Fields of Ambrosia is a musical written by Joel Higgins and Martin Silvestri. It was performed in the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick, New Jersey in 1993, and it was directed by Gregory Hurst, choreographed by Lynn Taylor Corbett, staged by Hurst, and set design by Deborah Jason. I don't know. Anyway, the cast included Christine Andreas as Gretchen Herzollerliebst. It's Ooh. A German name. Hopefully I don't have to say that again. Actually, mm-hmm. I do a couple of times, but it's
cool.
Can
you just say Herb?
Herzallerliebst.
Which part is the last name?
That's the last name. Oh. So her first name is Gretchen.
Okay. Her last name is
Herzallerliebst.
Okay.
It's fun. It's fun to say once you get it. Gretchen. Higgins, Joel Higgins as Jonas Candide, Peter Samuel as Warden Brodsky, and Eddie Corbic, I'm not exactly how to say his last name, as the mortician.
Okay.
Jimmy is also the name of the mortician. The 1996 production premiered at the Aldwych Theatre in London and was directed by Hirst again, with Mark Warman as the musical director, and the cast that included Andreas as Gretchen, Higgins as Jonas Candide, Michael Fenton Stevens as Doc, Mark Heenahan as Malcolm Piquant, Mark Joseph as Jimmy Crawford, Roger Leach as Warden Brodsky. Okay, that show closed only after 23 performances. The musical is based on the 1970 film The Traveling Executioner. This is why I went into IMDb. The New York Times said The Fields of Ambrosia is a black comedy and contains violence, sex, romance, and sentiment. I don't know why that's the last one listed.
That's so strange.
Yeah. It takes place in a deep rural town in America's South in 1918. Now, Ebony, if you were paying attention, you may have heard me mention the same name three times. Joel Higgins.
Yeah.
He co-wrote it. He starred in the New Jersey production and again starred in London as Jonas Candide. Joel Higgins was born in Bloomington, Illinois.
Oh, wow. I'm so glad we gave you this show.
I know. I didn't even know this until I looked it up and I was like, oh my gosh, my hometown. So cool.
So cool.
He was living there a lot earlier than I did. Although from the information, because he's still alive at this point, he's 78 years old. I don't know where he is within Illinois, but I believe he's still in the Midwest and I think Illinois. So probably like the Chicagoland area.
Mm-hmm.
But he was born September 28th, 1943. And in 1973, he landed the role of Vince in the first national tour of Greece. In 75, he won the Theater World Award for his role in the Broadway version of Shenandoah. Mm. In the same year, he began the role of Bruce Carson in the CBS soap opera Search for Tomorrow. And in the following year, he returned to Broadway for Music Is. In 1978, Higgins was featured in the role of Ben Gantt in the Broadway musical Angel. And I've actually, there's a couple of shows that I came across in my research today that I've added to our list.
Yeah. I mean, like a bunch of those you mentioned, I was like, no, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, totally. And so while the show Angel, while that show only ran for five nights, Higgins received a Drama Desk Award nomination for his performance in it. Higgins made the transition from daytime to primetime in 1979 with a starring role in the short-lived ABC television series Salvage One with Andy Griffith. Oh. 2 years later, I know, he starred in the ABC sitcom Best of the West. Higgins signed to star in a new NBC series, Silver Spoons. Do you remember that one?
Of course.
Playing Edward W. Stratton III, the childlike son of one of the country's richest industrialists. And in the show's opening, he learned he has a 12-year-old son played by Ricky Schroeder. The product of his first marriage, and the series ran from 82 to 87. I used to watch that.
Me too.
I feel like I used to watch that all the time.
Yeah, me too.
I remember the opening where he's like riding in the train all the way through his mansion. It's weird. Yeah. Like the things you remember when you're less than 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The first four seasons were aired on NBC and the fifth and final in first run syndication. So, and that was Silver Spoons. There's a lot. He's kind of jumping all over the place. He's got like a 40-year career span here.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And it runs the gamut of theater and TV and movies. He also wrote a bunch of jingles and theme songs. He's
like Jim Dale. Jim Dale is like that.
Yes, very much so. It says he continued to perform throughout the 90s and the 2000s, but like he was in She Loves Me at Music Center in Los Angeles. He did Oklahoma on Broadway back in the 80s. Like, so it wouldn't have been the first one. It would have been the first revival of that. He's done stuff at the Muni in St. Louis. Let's see. the Fox Theater in Atlanta, Starlight in Kansas City, and he returned to Broadway in 1991 and 92 to star as Stone and Stein in City of Angels.
Oh.
Yeah. Martin Silvestri, who co-wrote it with Joel Higgins, I couldn't find a lot about him. There's like literally like this man should have an enormous page on Wikipedia.
Because I feel like we've mentioned him in another show.
We have. And I can't remember what that show was. But like I had to kind of find all of these little bits and pieces from all over the place to kind of put him together. Mm-hmm. The theater-related information includes musical arrangements that he's made for both Broadway and national tours. So, like, he made musical arrangements for Josephine the Amazing, Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and, like, and just a couple of other ones that were listed that I didn't write down. On IMDb, there are some credits listed from the 1980s, and I did see that he was married to Christine Andreas, who starred in The Fields of Ambrosia, as well as a bunch of other musicals. She's still really... hard hitting in like touring with music and stuff like that. She's like, yeah, she's got a bunch of albums. Scarlet Pimpernel, she played the main woman lead along with my Terrence Mann. And that was one of my favorites. And also this, I got a kick out of her role as Alice in Legs Diamond was removed during previews.
Okay. I remember.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love that.
I remember that. That show was wow.
Yeah. We should like go back and do a recap of some of these episodes because I feel like they're all kind of coming up now again as we're doing these older musicals.
Mm-hmm.
So this, as I mentioned before, is based on The Traveling Executioner, which is a movie. So I'm fascinated when I'm reading about the reference material that authors use when they write musicals.
Mm-hmm.
And The Traveling Executioner is no exception. This was a 1970 American comedy drama film directed by Jack Smite and starring Stacey Keach, Bud Cort, Stefan Girosh, and Mariana Hill. The plot of this movie is that Jonas Candide, a former carnival showman, travels around the South in 1918 with his own portable electric chair, going from prison to prison with his young assistant Jimmy, charging $100 per execution. Two of Jonas' potential victims are siblings, Willie, and in this version, it's Gundrid Erzalerliebst. They changed that name to Gretchen for the musical, probably a smart choice. While Jonas successfully executes Willie, he falls for Gundrid, hoping to fake her execution. He does, but then things take a dark turn for him. Okay, so that sounds super interesting.
Yeah.
That's a film I'd watch, and that's a story I'd want to read. What could possibly go wrong? Let's dive in together.
Before we go on, I just want to say, before we leave the movie, I just want to say Stacey Keach, patron saint of this podcast, because he is the voice of American Greed, which like started us because of Rebecca. Oh,
thank you. I did not actually realize that. Yes. Oh, how funny. Hopefully. Fingers crossed. All right. So Fields of Ambrosia, if I can say the name, was never on Broadway. As I mentioned. They performed.
That's what I was like, you didn't say it. So I was like, it must have never made. Because
normally that's the first sentence.
Yeah.
I'm like, it opened on this day, closed on this day. It had this many previews and performances. I don't have any of that information.
Okay.
They performed at the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick, New Jersey in May of 93. Vague. The only reason I even know the month is because there's a New York Times article that was that had written a review, which I will reference later.
Okay.
But there are no dates listed on the internet for that production. And in fact, the only performance dates listed are for the production at the Aldwych Theatre in London, which previewed January 22nd, 1996. It opened January 31st, 96, and it closed February 10th, 1997. Oh, no, that was still 96. Okay. Here's the synopsis.
Okay.
Act one. A steamy summer morning in the rural deep south of 1918, a gang of prisoners works along the dusty roadway leading to the Fairweather State Prison. Jonas Candide, an ex-carnival barker and con man, who is now employed as the state's official traveling executioner, arrives at the prison with his electric chair. he's come to attend to his next clients, Willie and Gretchen Herzallerliebst. It gets easier as you go. Brother and sister German immigrants who have been convicted of murder. Upon arrival, Jonas learns from the warden that the woman has been granted a short stay while her lawyer tries to convince the governor to commute her sentence. Proceeding with Willie's execution, Jonas demonstrates his unique approach to the job, but something goes wrong. I don't know what goes wrong because they don't tell us in the synopsis, but something. Happy to put the day's events behind him, Jonas treats Jimmy, the gawky young town mortician who idolizes him, to a night of debauchery at the local whorehouse. Lovely. The next evening, to satisfy his curiosity, Jonas visits Gretchen Herzallerliebst in her cell. He's smitten by her beauty and wit. In return for her favors, Jonas is persuaded to buy her some more time by hiding his chair and convincing the warden that it was stolen. Gretchen's lawyer, not satisfied with that, discovers the hiding place and disables the chair with a fire axe. That's so gross. Like, that whole thing is, that whole paragraph is just gross. Yeah. Jonas must take the chair to the local fix-it shop for repair, where the sight of it creates quite a stir among the locals. Unable to stay away, he visits Gretchen again and is seduced even further. This, again, makes me angry.
Was written by a bunch of men.
Right. She's not seduced. She's not, I mean, I shouldn't say, she isn't seducing him. She's in prison.
Yeah.
You can't seduce someone when the power dynamic is not yours. Anywho, gross. Jonas comes up with the plan to save Gretchen. When the chair is ready, he will proceed with her execution, but give her only enough voltage to knock her out. Meanwhile, he will have struck a deal with the dissolute prison doctor to pronounce her dead and persuaded Jimmy to carry her out like a cadaver with no one the wiser. Doc is reluctant, saying that it's too risky and won't work, but Jonas demonstrates his theory on a prison rat, and the doc finally agrees to play his part for a $500 bribe. Jonas vows to somehow raise the money and free Gretchen. Act two.
Wait. I did miss.
Oh,
I must have not heard the, what was the chair?
Oh, he's got an electric chair that he just travels around with.
Like to just kill people in.
Yeah. It's like, cool. Old, what's the name of the one in Texas? I don't know. Old Sparky, I think is what it's called.
Okay.
Like an actual electric chair.
Wow.
Yeah. It's gross. It's problematic.
At minimum.
Gretchen takes the mandatory hour of exercise on the prison yard inside a huge wire cage, which protects her from the male prisoners. Jonas arrives and bribes the guard for a moment alone with Gretchen.
Never mind. Keep going.
You're going to say something that I know I'm thinking probably. Uh-huh. Jonas arrives and bribes the guard for a moment alone with Gretchen to let her know of his plan to save her. Jonas springs into action to raise the money to pay Doc. He smuggles the town whores into the prison late at night and, posting Jimmy as a lookout, turns Doc's infirmary into an impromptu bordello. Doc stumbles in and, seeing Jonas' resourcefulness, raises his asking price to $1,000. Jonas, wondering what the hell happened to his lookout, finds Jimmy completely distraught after being assaulted by some of the inmates. Moved by Jimmy's plight, Jonas makes him his new assistant. Because that's what he needs, a new job.
Mm-hmm.
Jonas gets into a high-stakes poker game and wins the $1,000, only to be jumped, beaten, and robbed by the losers. Bruised, bloody, and completely broke, Jonas returns to the prison to find Deputy Warden Picant ready to string Gretchen up while the warden is away at the county seat. By assuring him that the chair will be ready the next morning, Jonas gets him to relent. With time running out, Gretchen urges Jonas to try the local bank for the money. By whipping the bank's patrons into a patriotic fervor over war bonds, he convinces the manager to give him a loan. However, when the manager discovers that Jonas is an ex-con, he reneges. Jonas, in a panic, makes a play for the money. With the bank alarm ringing in his ears, he beats a hasty retreat back to the prison to spring Gretchen, but the escape attempt goes terribly wrong. Several months later, The prison yard is packed with guards and witnesses as Jonas Candide is placed in the refurbished electric chair by Jimmy, the new executioner. Jimmy gets so excited as Jonas regales him with descriptions of the hereafter that he revs the generator way too high. When Jimmy pulls the switch, everything goes up in flame and smoke. As the smoke begins to clear, we glimpse an image of Gretchen and Jonas alone on stage waltzing. Gross.
But I was just like, I think I missed all the funny parts.
It's nothing. Like, here's... I wrote the paragraph.
Is it because I didn't see it? I'm like, this is not...
Well, okay, because this is exactly what I wrote afterward. I wrote gross. There's a lot that's problematic to that story.
Yeah.
And I think that we can all agree it's in turn incredibly dark and then monstrously tone deaf, though that might be just our own biased modern sensibilities coloring it.
It's like 21st century. This was like the 90s. And then it was like from where was it from? The 70s?
Exactly. 1970.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
1970 when the movie came out, and there wasn't a huge difference between 1970 and 1990 as far as the masochistic, you know, toxic masculinity that was in play. I do suppose that, like, reading this two paragraph plot summary isn't an alternative to actually watching it play out in front of you. So perhaps it would be different if we were actually, like, in the theater or watching it on the movie screen or on the stage.
Right.
But I also,
maybe, like, I was like, is it in the way that it's played? Because listening to the synopsis, it's not funny at all.
It's not.
But maybe in the way that things are played and stuff, it's has some comedy bits.
I think you're right. I mean,
and
of course,
the part I was getting upset about is, like, of course she's in a cage to be protected instead of the other way around, which is, like, the thing we're still dealing with is, like, it's the woman's fault. So, like, she needs to do X, Y, or Z, or we need to put her here so that she's protected instead of telling
she gets the
offender
to keep
like
her...
get their crap together and stop offending people. But okay, I'm done.
But, like, also, if you consider that then Jimmy was later assaulted, and by assaulted, it's not just a beaten up. He's not just being beaten up, right?
Right.
He was later assaulted. It tells me that there is no, like, no one's in charge of the jail.
No.
Like, Jonas was just able to pay the warden, who then turned a blind eye to him entering the prison, but then it's a free for all.
Right.
It's based in 1918, so maybe things were a little bit different in the prison system back then. I don't think that it's not the way it works now.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean,
they don't have women and men together, certainly.
No, certainly not. It's certainly not co-ed. But then, of course, now we're dealing with a lot of, like, transgender people who are being forced to put
right.
And so that's a big issue. And then, you know, I mean. The prison system is, like, super corrupt.
Yeah.
And
well, it's privatized.
It's privatized. People, I mean, it's like modern day slavery. I mean, it's still pretty terrible. It's not technically a free for all, but basically is. I mean, it has its own sort of, like, ecosystem and set of rules and everything inside.
Right.
That still, I mean, you know, people. It's not rehabilitation.
No.
That's.
No. Oh, no. Oh, okay. I thought I lost you for a second because
I'm here.
You just stopped talking. And I was like, oh, no. Okay. No, but you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so let's get back.
I'm like, is it based on Greek mythology? Because you're like, the ambrosia part is, like, of the gods or something.
No, it's absolutely not. I think it's just the word ambrosia. So there's a song that is sung the first time when Jonas is putting a man to death, and to kind of ease him into his transition, the inmate who's being killed, to ease him into his transition, Jonas is singing about the fields of ambrosia that he's going to encounter as soon as, you know, he's electrocuted. As soon as he crosses to the other side, there'll be, you know, this wonderful heaven. that he sings about. And he sings that reprise several times, including when he is about to be put to death as well. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't think it has anything to do with that other than the reference of ambrosia. And the only, I only put that together, like that's my contextual stringing together. It's not necessarily what they intended, but that's what I think.
Okay.
Just from my own knowledge of what ambrosia is and has been. Does that make sense?
Right. Yep, it makes sense.
Okay. There was an article written by Paul Taylor on February 2nd of 1996 for The Independent in England. He reviews this show with as much duality as I felt doing this research. Mm. The end of his article states, and I quote, "The second half of the show left this critic weak and weak with bliss as it trampled over good taste and political correctness like a herd of bullocks. One way it tries to stick up for the love, quote unquote, between the two main characters is to intimate that the prison is otherwise a hotbed of filthy perversion. A big butch warden, Mark Heenahan, who is Jonas' violent rival for Gretchen's favors, evidently consoles himself with impressionable male convicts." This is why I kind of mentioned that it's incredibly dark.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, this was my voice poking in. There, I can't imagine any of this being portrayed in a black comedy, in a musical, on stage in the early 90s. Like, none of this is, like, making any sense to me.
No.
Which is why I think it probably was portrayed much more on the comedy side of things.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you, and I always consider Sweeney Todd as one of, like, the epitome of a black comedy, right? This, I'm not sure, would have been as successful as Sweeney Todd was in that way. Because, but also, I mean, I feel like we, as a society, or at least a good portion of us, have become much more awakened to the idea that any kind of sexual assault or corruption, manipulation, sexual or otherwise. And in this case, there's definitely, this comes in huge amounts, especially where Gretchen is concerned, because whether or not she actually committed a crime, and we never find that out.
Okay.
Whether or not she is guilty of murder, she certainly does not deserve to be manipulated and extorted and blackmailed and then made to feel like she, the only path she has forward is to do whatever the man says.
Yeah.
So, but that was the early 90s. And I think it is, you know, unfortunately, it is a little bit different. Sexual perversion was the butt of the joke at that time.
What is it, rape culture?
Yeah You know, it's the boys will be boys kind of scenario. And that's giving excuse to men's behavior, but in the entertainment side of it, it was always the kind of the butt of the joke.
That kind of
power, that if one had authority over the other, and this was playing out, that was always made to be funny. You know, it was never. I think now we make it a much more dramatic thing in the TVs and movie and whatever else that you're doing. But at the time, I don't know. That's just, I mean, that's again just my another 2 cents.
I'm but it's trying, you know, trying to make some.
Yeah.
Trying to understand it, just like piece together what it is or could have been.
Yeah. Exactly right. Exactly right. You know, and trying to, I guess we, you and I, when we're doing these shows, kind of do have to, put our own modern take on things because that's our experience. That's our lived experience. But we also kind of have to go back in time and say, well, in 1993, what would have been the climate? What, you know, what would have been acceptable that is absolutely not acceptable now?
Right.
Which doesn't make it right. It just makes it more understandable when you're kind of reading the outside, reading from the outside looking in.
And it doesn't, we agree, it doesn't make it right. We're not saying this is okay. We're just saying this is why it happened.
Right. I mean, and there is more to this independent article, but it seems like Paul Taylor's take on it does. I mean, he says that he was kind of, you know, what was his wording? Let me find it. Oh, sorry. I lost it. Something about bliss.
Yeah. That's what the opening he said.
Yeah, this critic was weak with bliss, mm-hmm. but as it trampled over good taste and political correctness.
Yeah.
So even he is kind of Jekyll and Hyde in this article.
Right.
And I feel like even he is saying, you know, looking at it from the outside in and seeing the story, it's one thing, but then what we're told to think about it is a completely other thing.
Yeah.
So he goes on to say, Paul Taylor in this article goes on to say, Mark Joseph's scrawny young mortician, a signal failure with women. I don't know what that means. That must be like a British saying, mm-hmm. but it means that he just wasn't good with girls.
Mm-hmm.
Finds himself raped by two prisoners. And he says, if it ain't one thing, it's another, which inspired the opening line of a subsequent song about the family deprivation that has made him this isolated victim. So I think it is trying to kind of just, you know, it doesn't want to give completely. But I think what the musical is trying to do is not give any gravity to those consequences at all. So it's like, okay, yeah, that happened, but oh, if it ain't one thing, it's another. You know, it's just, it's awful.
Wow.
Rarely you feel can loneliness have been quite so stage struck as you listen to Mr. Joseph hollering alone, all alone. Certainly his is a decibel rich need that would empty rooms with some rapidity. Often very funny in its own right, the show has a number of moments where it seems to be tone deaf in its own ridiculousness.
Mm.
To sing about letting sleeping dogs lie when you have a comatose rat on the operating table, as Michael Fenton Stevens' Whiskey Doctor does, is to throw the cat among the pigeons sense-wise. With high voltage performances all around, though, and a strong so bad it's good factor, this show makes a pretty sunny vacation from seriousness and propriety. So it's interesting. I mean, it's such like a, it's so two sides of one coin where you can only look at one side or the other. So it's like, it's either really dark and really weighty, or it's just kind of like making fun of itself and ridiculous. And this is, you know, I don't know. It's so difficult to kind of get a read on it. Another review, and this is from ilsay.com, which is mm-hmm. the one that I mentioned before. So ilsay.com, I believe, is a review of albums, of like CD albums.
Okay.
So this is a review of the CD cast recording of The Fields of Ambrosia by David Spencer. And it was in 1996. So right when the CD came out and the show was on the stage. It says, The Fields of Ambrosia is a musical that has had a long, tough road to earn its imminent London premiere on January 31st at the Aldwych in the West End, but it has the advantage of a solid, successful regional production behind it at New Jersey's George Street Playhouse in 93. A clear vision of what it wants to be, a rich Americana-type score that maintains a savvy contemporary sensibility, a terrific story, and one of the best, most underrated leading men, and also on a personal note, one of the nicest fellows in the business, Joel Higgins,
wow.
who, interestingly enough, is also author of the book and lyrics. From the press release, quote, set in rural Louisiana in 1918, The Fields of Ambrosia tells an extraordinary love story. Jonas Candide, former carnival con man, falls head over heels for Gretchen, the most alluring woman he's ever met. But there are complications. Jonas is now the state executioner and Gretchen is destined to be his next client. As the clock ticks down the days, Jonas schemes to set her free before he must carry out her sentence. What's exciting about the thumbnail description is how immediately the situation and the leading character are both human and larger than life. What's unfortunate is that the album's jewel box pamphlet only contains lyrics, no notes or plot summary. And I'm not sure the parameters of the tale are quite clear from the album's 16 or so minutes of material.
Mm-hmm.
Not on the first listening anyway, though repeated listenings may begin to paint enough of a picture. I agree with that. Like, so I had this CD and this was one of those times where I went into the music store and I was looking at all of the covers and I was picking them up and reading the back, and Fields of Ambrosia was one of those that I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. I'll get it. But when I open up a CD, I take out the libretto and I open it up and I read through all the pages. And if there's lyrics, I play the CD and I read along with them. And if there's the plot synopsis, I will read through that as well. And if it doesn't have it, then I agree with what this guy is saying, where you're just kind of a little bit lost until you fill in the context for yourself. But after reading the synopsis or the plot summary from before, I would almost be even more confused. And I don't know how I felt when I first read it, because I would have purchased this back in perhaps even at the time that it came out, because it would have been while I was in high school. So it would have been 94, 95, somewhere in there, maybe a little bit later than that. Anyway, so he goes on to say, I'm just doing a lot of tangents. This is fun. The music has a nice Americana sweep to it, and the lyrics have the ring of storytelling musical theater in the Rodgers and Hammerstein tradition. However, the sensibility remains contemporary. Stylistically, Higgins and Silvestri are certainly influenced, but they're not beholden. Because the lyrics are so easily demotic and countrified, their wit is more subtle than surface. One can smile indulgently at the Carney Barker's assurance that in Fields of Ambrosia, everyone knows ya. But upon repeated listenings, you realize just how subtly persuasive Jonas can be when he's not cagily rhyming and simply choosing the right image for his pitch, for the job, for the setting, and for, indeed, the location of the show. Some of the lyrics also state, "And you sit by a crick and go fishing forever," or "No worries at all, except maybe that nectar, or what nectar to drink." So these are, this is the way that he, Jonas was painting what the afterlife was for these men that he was about to electrocute. The performances are as persuasive as the material. There could not be a more charming hustler than Mr. Higgins, nor a more alluring death row prisoner than Miss Andreas, who shares with her leading man the dubious distinction of being underrated, underused, and underappreciated. I will absolutely agree with that. But maybe the Fields of Ambrosia will change all that. Oh, that didn't age well. Ebony, I don't know why this never made it to Broadway. There was no scandal. There wasn't even a flop as far as the critics are concerned. And it was always meant, I think it was always meant to be a limited run in New Jersey, but not in the West End. And I couldn't understand why it didn't move forward. That is, until I read another article.
Oh, great.
I know. This was on thesandpaper.net, written on September 8th, 2022.
Oh, wow.
By Rick Mellerup. That's right. 16 days ago, as I'm recording.
Amazing.
I know. So apparently there's a production happening right now through September 25th at the Surflight Theater in Beach Haven, New Jersey.
Oh, wow.
In that article on thesandpaper.net, it says, "The George Street production was a big one with a cast of 22 and multiple sets, thanks to the use of two turntables. Silvestri and Higgins didn't want to shrink it to off-Broadway size, but a Broadway show would have cost $8 million, according to Silvestri, and only $4 million could be had."
Yeah.
So they decided to make it an end run and took the show to London, to the West End's Aldwych Theatre in 96, again starring Higgins and Andreas. English audience were not sold, and the show closed after just 23 performances. Silvestri said it was too American for England. And the poor British reaction put the Fields of Ambrosia on the shelf. Silvestri goes on to say, "We moved on to Johnny Guitar," which was another show that he and Joel Higgins wrote together, which was an off-Broadway hit that they had won the Outer Critics Circle Award as Off-Broadway's best musical in 2004.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Surflight's producing artistic director Steve Steiner had been in the cast of the George Street production.
Oh, wow.
And he never forgot the musical. So he got together with Silvestri, Higgins, and Andreas. And the result will be the third ever production of The Fields of Ambrosia. Does that mean, though, that it may make a play for Broadway? I guess only time will tell, because the internet didn't.
But how?
To make it to Broadway, you mean?
Because
I mean,
it would now, like, it's the 21st century. Like, this, like, exactly what we're talking about. How, okay, 90s, 70s, 1800s. Totally different sensibilities in 2022.
Right.
So what are they doing about it for the 21st century audience is what I'm really interested in understanding. Because, like, how is it doing there? I mean, the 25th is, you know, next weekend, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, as of when we're recording this.
Right.
And so I'm very confused in the synopsis that we read. How?
Yeah. Well, and again, I think there's going to be confusion on our part because we haven't seen it. And there's no way to really know that it's truly problematic unless you see it, right? Because
I
couldn't even get my hands on a script.
Okay.
I don't know. I couldn't find any way, but I didn't do a deep dive on that. I would imagine that the answer is no. Who knows? I didn't check out the Surflight. It's surflight.net, I believe, or surflight.org is the theater where it's performing right now. I didn't check them out to see, like, I checked out the page of Fields of Ambrosia. It didn't immediately seem like there was video or pictures of it, but I didn't dive much further than just that page. It would have, I mean, from our perspective, just having read what we've read, it would have to have an overhaul.
Yeah.
The vantage point and the focal point would have to drastically change. But I don't think it's beyond it. Like, if you look at a movie like The Green Mile or Shawshank Redemption, those two are also very dated in that when they came out, it was the early 90s and it was the same kind of content. In prison with a lot of the stuff that was happening in prison that we, of course, didn't believe until most recently. But as they have aged, we've been able to go with them, right? There's nothing so overtly problematic or disgusting in watching those that you can't be like, oh, yeah, that's a good movie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know. I know. And listen, you can take everything I say with a grain of salt because I kind of do too. I mean, I'm not trying to convince anybody at this point. But the movie, and I tried to find the movie, the way that you can watch it is to rent it on iTunes, the Traveling Executioner, the movie. Mm-hmm. I did not have time to do that today.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about possibly doing it in the future. We shall see. But it's interesting to know what they did with the movie, because if the show is slightly different from the movie, then perhaps you can go back to what the movie offered and it would be more in line with something that was palatable for today's sensibilities.
Yeah.
But there's, I don't know.
On NewJerseyStage.com, there are photos from the Surflight Theater's production of The Fields of Ambrosia.
Great.
Those were posted on 9/11.
Okay. And that's NewJerseyTheater.com?
NewJerseyStage.com.
Stage.com. Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool.
I mean, I see from the pictures, I can see the comedy.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Like, it's not, it's really not played with any seriousness, but the synopsis is like,
yeah.
I mean, that was not fun. at all.
No. So I have not listened to the CD since I bought it in the early 90s, or maybe even late 90s. And I didn't get a chance to do that today while I was doing this episode. But it also could be that listening to it gives an air of comedy over the darker story.
Maybe. I just can't get over. It's just like people getting raped.
Yeah.
How?
Yeah.
I'm struggling.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, that's the part I'm finding fascinating. A, is that somebody's doing it right now as we speak.
Yeah. Well, the thing is too, I mean, like if you read all of the critics, they were all like, this is great. This is a good show. Some of them were conflicted as far as some of the things, but like no one was overtly like, this is a terrible piece of crap. And it's the worst thing since, I was going to say sliced bread.
I was thinking since Carrie.
There you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's better than sliced bread.
Yeah.
However, and so, you know, as going from that, it does make sense that it may be a good enough show to bring back. I don't know, though. Here, I'm looking at the photos now. You're absolutely right. It's very...
It's broad. It's played it's broad.
Very broad. Right. It's musical comedy at its best. You've got these dance numbers and people's faces and attitudes are all very large and out there and, you know, over the top.
We'll put a link in the really show beautiful. Notes.
Yeah.
Geeks. So you can see the photos. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because I'm thinking about Pretty Belle.
Oh yeah.
As you're talking about this and the next episode we'll record definitely has a strong connection to Pretty Belle. Yeah.
Well, here's the difference though. And I maybe this is the difference. Mm-hmm. Pretty Belle was telling the story of the tragic woman from the tragic woman's point of view.
Right. Right.
And audiences at that point wouldn't have wanted that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're just getting to a point where people are starting to listen to women in just a day-to-day life, right?
Right.
And so, like, you know, entertainment-wise, theatrically, they probably scoffed at it. They're like, I mean, Angela Lansbury's great and all, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This isn't about – this is told from the man's point of view. Mm-hmm. Who is doing the killing. So if he's the one that's telling the story of the show, then of course he's going to kind of gloss over the bits that paint him in a bad light.
Yeah.
That is so fascinating to me too. It really is truly fascinating to me to kind of like, and this is why I love storytelling.
Yeah.
And this is also why I love kind of dissecting stories after they've already been told for a good amount of time, because like there are so many things that come into receiving a story, and it would have been very black and white at the time that it was told the first time, but over time so many more colors have been entered into the mainstream, into the perception of the people that are listening to the story, so it changes the story, right? Mm-hmm. Like, then that's just generally speaking. I'm not even saying for this story. I'm just saying, like, overall, that's what happens. We, as individual people and as collective communities of people, we grow up. We get more experience. We have lived and learned and now look at things a different way. So a movie that I saw as a kid is going to be a completely different movie when I watch it as an adult.
Right,
and that's the human existence, right? That's the kind of a fascinating thing as well. I lost my train of thought, Ebony.
You know, like musicals about...
Oh, that's what I was going to say. Thank you. Oh,
okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So my point in saying all of that was that you've got one story that can be told from the points of view of however many people that you want it to be told from, right? And yeah, it's a right. completely different story from each person.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that is what's fascinating about it. Because like yeah. in this particular version, Jonas is the one that tells his narrative and he's the one that shares all the information. He's the one that we've got to believe as an audience. But what if it was told from the perspective of Jimmy? Or mm-hmm. what if it was told from the perspective of Gretchen? And right. honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, Gretchen is a complete throwaway character. We don't even know if she actually committed murder. Like right. she's just this, we just see her in a jail. We're told that she's committed murder, but we don't know anything about her.
Although just for that, I would say, you know, I thought about Chicago and how the innocent character has said, not guilty, but the only reason we know for sure she's not guilty is because we see during Cell Block Tango that she has the white handkerchief.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it, again, it's like that we didn't get to see it. So there's possibility like in the way that the story is told, we find out whether or not she did it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have no doubt. I have no doubt that that's and it could have. It, who knows if Christine Andreas wanted to play it different ways each night.
Right.
I mean,
right.
like that's that's kind of the fun of that. But what I mean is like, you know, like every woman ever written in musical theater, she's two dimensional.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's not even two dimensional, really. She's just kind of like, I don't know. It's anyway.
As you can tell, I think we're pretty conflicted about this one also.
We are.
I think we're really trying to figure it out.
Yeah, we are. I mean, I'd like to see it. I'd like to see the original source material and kind of like, you know, base my actual opinion then on that once I've got all of the information. But I think I've always been a feminist, even when I was very young. I was raised to be by both of my parents, to be a strong and independent woman, to be able to take care of myself, because God forbid if I was married and my husband died, like what would I do? That kind of, you know, that was what I was told by my mom. She's like, listen, your grandmother, her mother, you know, her husband, and she was talking about her own father in this, and this actually makes me kind of sad now that I'm saying it out loud now. And she was like, you know, her husband basically left her on her own to raise three girls. You know, he was living there, but he wasn't there, you know, and so she had to work and she had to pay the bills and she had to make the budget and she needed to make sure that everything was taken care of on the day-to-day basis, right? And so my mom, with that kind of generational trauma intact, kind of, you know, treated her daughters with that same information and said, listen, I don't want this to happen to you, but if it does happen to you, I want you to be prepared for it. And that's not a bad thing, right?
Right.
To be prepared, to be, you know, I'm very glad that I was raised to be a strong, independent woman. And to appreciate the fact that I am a woman and not to let that be the thing that holds me back.
Right.
I'm not going to let that happen. Now, as I've gotten older and as I have lost the ability to care what other people think about me, it's even stronger.
Right.
So it is very difficult to dissect that portion of myself when I am reading through new material. So books that I read are often colored with my own feminist ideals. Movies that I watch and TV shows that I watch are definitely colored from that vein of thinking.
Right.
So in that respect too, that's another fascinating thing to kind of think about, because you've got different perspectives telling a story, but you've also got different human beings taking that story and receiving it. And from one person to the next, it could be received in a completely different way.
Right.
And is perceived in a completely different way. It has to be, because it's based on your own lived experience.
Right.
Anyway, and this is just one of those stories that has a lot of triggers in it, I think.
Yeah.
For a lot of people.
I don't know.
I don't either.
I'm very curious how this one will be received.
Yeah.
I found the article with the pictures. It might have a review in there. Obviously we're on here now, so I don't have time to read it, but.
Right. Can you imagine if we were just like, okay, give us a second. And yeah, it was we're just silence for 5 minutes.
Yeah. It's like, we'll put the link in the show notes and yeah. They can, you know, you can look at it yourself.
I always suggest that you take whatever we say with a grain of salt.
And do the research yourself.
And do the research, exactly. And find out what you feel like on your own. I think that is what the fun of theater is about as well. You know, it's meant to be thought-provoking.
Mm-hmm.
This has certainly provoked a lot of thoughts in me, and I think in you as well.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that it has sparked some thoughts in our audience as well. Let us know if you want to share your thoughts. You can reach out. We'd love to hear.
We'd love Twitter, email. You know how to do it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, so do you want to just quick wrap up with the other?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, and this is something that I missed and you did too, which is kind of amazing to me. I thought for sure you're going to be like, oh yeah, I saw that. Mm-mm. I was on Facebook, which I am still on because I'm not on Twitter. It doesn't make any difference. But anyway, I was on Facebook and I was just kind of reading through and like all of my phantom friends were posting this thing, this article that showed us that the Phantom of the Opera, which has been running now for 35 years on Broadway, it is the longest running show in Broadway history, is going to be closing this upcoming February 2023.
Yeah.
I never thought this show was ever going to close.
I know. I know.
But I guess
I'm really surprised.
Totally surprised. I mean, I guess that's what they said about Cats as well. When Cats was the longest running show and then it closed and people were like, whoa, I didn't think that was ever going to close. But like Phantom, because Phantom has been on Broadway almost as long as you and I have been alive.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem like it could go anywhere.
Right.
Odd. I mean, it's just it's an so odd weird feeling. And Juliet, my friend, my best friend Juliet, who I met doing the Phantom tour and who has remained my best friend since then, posted it as well. And she reached out via text when I had responded to her post. And she goes, What do you think about this? I'm a little sad. And I went, yeah, I'm sad that such a long-running show is going away. It's not going to be there anymore. But I didn't know how to interpret my own feelings because for some reason it didn't feel personal.
Well, right.
But it kind of is. I mean, if you really kind of like, if I look at the story of my life, Phantom of the Opera was a big part of my life. It got me my equity card. It started me off on my career in theater where it was no longer just the regional stuff. I was like, I felt like I had finally, you know, taken this huge step into my career.
Yeah.
It is what got me to move to New York. It is really what got me to be more comfortable leaving the city and state that I was in. I was feeling real comfortable living in the Midwest. And I grew up on the tour. I got Sweet Pea while I was on that tour. I grew up, you know, doing Phantom of the Opera for 4.5 years. So it is sad that it's not going to be around anymore. But I also kind of feel like it abandoned me. When that show closed,
the tour
suddenly, when our tour, which was the third national tour of the Music Box Company national tour, when that show closed, it was almost like I didn't exist anymore. And I'm not really one to have a show as my identity. So I wasn't really affected by that as much as I was just like seeing some of the people that were on the road with me now moving into the Broadway cast. And I wasn't thought of to do that. Like, and so then I was like, well, that makes me feel gross and icky. And I didn't want to feel that anymore. So I think I just kind of threw that away. Not my experiences, because my experiences were still really amazing. I mean, what is in front of me on my wall in my apartment in Astoria is a giant map with pins and string showing all of the different locations that I've been in the United States and also Canada and just Canada, not Mexico, just Canada, of both the Phantom Tour and the Wicked Tour. I'm looking right now at pictures of the show Phantom that I was in, that, you know, the pictures are of me and the pictures are of the chandelier and the truck that we drove. And I've got, you know, a Squiggs painting that was commissioned for us by Sean, who played Raoul when we closed, that he gave prints to for everybody in the cast. And I'm looking at pictures and I'm looking at different, you know, sentimental items. So it's not that it means nothing to me, but it does feel like I meant nothing to them. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and maybe that is still a me, and it is still a me problem, but it's at the same time, it's hard for me to kind of feel any which way about the show closing on a personal level, right, when that's how they kind of made me feel at the end.
That's valid. That makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Yeah. This is good therapy. I mean, truly, to kind of talk this out, because it's not something, I mean, like, I'm not looking in the mirror talking through all of this stuff in my own head. So it's nice to be able to kind of put it out there and just to kind of speak freedom to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. I mean, it is sad. I am sad that we'll be losing this mainstay. But it also kind of is exciting because now the Majestic is going to be open.
I know. My feeling was, yeah, I'm sad because it's been open like most of my existence, mm-hmm, on the planet. But I got really excited about what else could be in there.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's how I'm also sad because, like, I shocked myself how upset I got when Hal Prince died. I didn't expect to have such a strong reaction. And so that, like, this was the last, you know, thing we had of him that was, like, still going.
Sure.
You know, so, but I have a real strong excitement, even though, listen, I think I've been pretty clear about not being super excited about the musical theater coming this next season.
Right.
Still, I continue to hope that we'll make good choices.
Yeah.
You
know, everything historically speaking is cyclical.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have no doubt that we'll get back to the vein of, like, good storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of when.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, like I've said, there's some plays I'm really excited about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited about Ohio State Murders. Like, the more I sort of read about it, I'm, like, really, really pumped about that one. And, but the musical scene is,
yeah, it's a little anemic.
Yeah. So, that's it. We just wanted to give a little time to that announcement that, as we recorded this, came out this week.
Right.
So, also tweet at us and, you know, add us on Instagram or email us about your thoughts and feelings about Phantom closing. We'd love to hear those as well.
Yes, please.
All right, friends. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to our podcast, Theater Geeks Anonymous. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at
TGABway and on Facebook at Theater Geeks Anonymous.
And if you want to tell us how much you love us, or you have a great story about one of the shows we've talked about, drop us a note at
TGABway@gmail.com. You can also support us by going to patreon.com/TGABWAY. Until next time, geeks!
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.